We're going through a series called The Kingdom Society at a Larger Level. So that's throughout the whole year, and it's about how do we become people of the kingdom. We talk about Jesus invites us to embody his spirit, his resurrection life together as a church, and it is for the healing of the world. So how do we become those kinds of people? And then beyond that, it's broken up into different movements. So we've been talking about what is the gospel, what is the kingdom that Jesus invites us to, what is the spirit of God, and how is the spirit moving in and amongst the world and us? How can we join him and participate in that together? And now we're talking about this idea of like actually embodying the life of Jesus, because that's what he invites us to. He says he sends us out into the world filled with his spirit the same way that he was sent. And so what does it look like to actually not just say that as like a slogan, but actually embody him? And so we're breaking it up into lots of different steps of embodiment. And we talked about relationships for a while. Now we're talking about what I'm calling gospel orientations. And so the idea is, how do we actually orient ourselves towards the world as a kingdom people that embody the spirit of the living God? And there's a lot of different things that are happening. There's ways of participating in the world and engaging the world that almost call us into like division or call us into controversy. There's like hot topics, sort of burning things that are creating all sorts of polarization. And often we're given like an either or. We're given a this or that, left or right, this party, that party, like right or wrong. It's like this dividing sort of thing, and it can create chaos, not only in a society, but it can create chaos in like the church and even in a community here on the ground, or we can become like very infighting and very frustrated. But the reality is Jesus, he calls us to something different than that. He calls us to what we've been calling like the third way, where to be a person of Jesus' kingdom means that if your primary allegiance is to Jesus, then he sort of pulls us out of that, turns us sideways, and drops us back in and says, whoa, that feels different, right? And so it's like a third way of orienting ourselves in the world when it comes to how we're understanding some of the big issues, some of the big things, some of the big ways of engaging. The reality is, as Christians, we don't have the luxury of the kind of faith that would say, Jesus died so I can go to heaven when I die, therefore I'll bury my head in the sand and just wait till that happens. Like, that's not the kind of thing that Jesus gives or offers or invites us to. There's nothing like that in the scripture. It's that he sends you out for the healing of the world, filled with his spirit as like a reconciling force. And so he gives us a different way of living and being in the world in that sense. And so last week we talked about the idea of violence in that regard. This week I want to talk about politics. Not candidates, not parties, not even policies. We actually talked about this 3 years ago. It was the Sunday before the election. And I don't know if any of you heard anything I said, because it was the Sunday before the election. We were probably like a year too late on that conversation. Though I think it provided a sweet sense of community, connection, and peace in the moment. But I think if we're going to have these kind of conversations, we should be having them in 2019, probably not 2020. So we can be a church that builds into what it looks like to engage really well. Because you're theologians. Whether you think you are or not, you have an idea of who God is and the way the world works, and you engage that way. And if you're going to follow Jesus, then you're called to think in a theological way about everything. Everything you do is theological, because it has some sort of saying of who God is and the way God made the world and how the world works. So everything you do has a theological connotation to it. And so there's an invitation to think in those terms. And Jesus, he talks about politics. He actually engages in them quite dramatically. He lived in a very volatile, explosive political world, in which ours would really pale in comparison. We're like amateur hour polarization as opposed to what he was going through when it comes to like political engagement. But what he has to say is profound. I'll also say this, this kind of conversation provides more of a framework from Jesus on how to engage the whole thing. So it isn't going to be like, therefore, here's your voter guide, or therefore, here's all your answers. It's more of a beginning point that will hopefully spark a whole lot of conversation where those of us who are coming from lots of different perspectives, which I'm assuming we are because we're a room full of people, that will be able to have really thoughtful, intelligent, like growing sort of discussions and dialogues and sharpen each other and become a community that embodies Jesus in all the areas, right? So lean in, engage it. Matthew 22. We're looking at verse 15. Okay. Then the Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap him in his words. Him is Jesus. It's never a good start to one of the Jesus stories and people are like openly ambushing him. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians. Teacher, they said, we know that you're a man of integrity and that you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. You aren't swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay the poll tax to Caesar or not? So all that was like smoke and mirror flattery. False. But Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, you hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? Show me the coin used for paying the tax. And they brought him a denarius, and he asked them, whose image is this and whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. Then he said to them, so give back to Caesar what's Caesar's and to God what is God's. And when they heard this, they were amazed, so they left him and they went away. So at first glance, that can be like, oh, Jesus is so crafty with his words. He got him, you know, it's like a, I don't know what you would call that, like an intellectual, like kung fu match in which Jesus won. But there's a lot heavier consequences to that whole story than you may realize. So if you look at the context of the situation, it was really divided and explosive. And so we've talked a bit about Jesus's world and context. He lives in a Jewish world, but that's occupied by a Roman Empire and by that military army, and like a full occupation of their land, which is like an imposed will. It's a political military occupation with a full army that is present. And if you cross this occupying force, they kill you and often hang you on crosses as like an example of not being a rebel to their enforced will and their enforced power over them. Herod was a king of that land. He was a half-breed Jew, and he was like a puppet king. So the way the Romans worked is they would conquer a land and they would identify someone who was a sympathizer to their cause, who was also greedy for power, and they would empower them to be the king over that land, but really they weren't. They just did whatever the Romans told them to do, but they got the benefits of the power and the wealth that came with it. So the Herodians are Herod's people, this half-breed Jew who's benefiting off the sort of power structures of the day. And the way it worked is the Romans had built army barracks onto the side of their temple complex, which is like unimaginable for the Jewish people to have this existing there, and they're constantly watching everything they do and they worship, because if they cross the line, they can bum rush into the worship. It'd be like if there was like a military barracks right there and we're like, I see you, I'm talking. You know what I mean? They're watching everything that's happening, and if you cross the line, if you say something out of line, if you do any, they're going to rush in and just stop it in the moment. And it was a heavy sort of occupying force that's happening. And when we talk about the taxes, there's strong, heavy, like specific taxes that were actually designed to humiliate the people and subjugate them, and while simultaneously paying the very force that's occupying them. So you're paying the people with your taxes in a humiliating way who will kill you if you get out of line. It'd be like imagining like our most hated sort of enemies as a nation who conquered us and then occupy us. It's you see Man in the High Castle? The show on Amazon? It's a story of what happens if the Nazis won the war, and then it's like a Nazi-occupied America sort of feeling. It's wild, it's like watching that whole thing play out and this drama that they created. It'd be something along that line. So this tax that they're asking about is that tax. They believe the taxation system was so heavy because there's so many taxes like levied up on them at a time that it was as much as 70% of their income total, which is such an oppressive thing that people were literally selling their family into like servitude in order to survive and selling off their family land. And it's like a struggle, man. It's a serious struggle, and if you didn't pay the tax, you were a rebel, and they could crucify you and kill you. So in Sepphoris, a town right by there at this exact same time, they decided to rebel and not pay the tax, and they hung 2,000 of them on the roadside so that everyone would see what happens when you don't pay your taxes. Heavy April 15th. That's why the stories of the tax collectors are so heavy in the New Testament, because there were Jewish people that were hired to collect tax, and they got the skim off the top, and they were super rich. It's wild stuff. But it wasn't just like a financial, political oppression. It was a religious, like blasphemous oppression. So the coin, would you throw the slide up, was a denarius, and that's a picture of one. And if you look at it, it's got some images, and it's got some inscriptions on it. There's a picture of Caesar Tiberius, the emperor, on one side with the inscription, Caesar Augustus Tiberius, son of the divine Augustus. So he's the son of a god. The other side, it says the highest priest. So this is a divine person who is also the high priest of the entire land, whose image is on the coin. In a Jewish society, you don't even like have graven images. You would never have an image of anyone on anything, much less the image of someone claiming to be a god that you would then carry in your pocket, and then that's the money you use to pay your taxes to the people that are occupying. It's like an act of blasphemy just to pay taxes. And so it's like an intentional heavy burden that these people carry. And this particular tax started right when Jesus, right before he was born, when they did the census and they were counting him in the like nativity story, because they were seeing how much wealth the Jewish people had, and now they levied this tax on them. But it's a wild story. I mean, it's a heavy, heavy sort of politically, religiously insulting, blasphemous, upsetting, oppressive tax that they're living under. But then there's the people in the story. So there's the Pharisees and the Herodians, and the Pharisees are really powerful, conservative religious leaders that are absolutely anti-Rome and anti-tax, and they're praying that God will smite the Romans so that they can get rid of them, and they're actually afraid of Jesus, because they're afraid that he's starting a movement, and the people are getting on board, and if Jesus actually rallies a movement and he pulls it off, if he's successful in creating a revolt, what they're afraid of is that he's going to lose. And if he loses, the full weight of the Roman Empire will come down and crush them, and they'll just be gone as a people. It happened after Jesus died in the year 70. Another Messiah rose up that they called Bar Kokhba, the son of a star, and when he came into power, they put their full weight behind him, and when the rebellion rose, the Romans came, and there wasn't one stone left on another in the temple, and they've been scattered ever since, until recently when the nation-state of Israel was put back into place after World War II. It's wild, right? So that's what they're afraid of. Is that kind of scattering. The Herodians, on the other hand, are like the sort of half-breed Jewish Roman sympathizer people, and they're trying to capitalize on the moment, and they're in power, and they like the money, and so they're afraid Jesus is going to start a movement and win. Because if he wins, they're going to lose power, and they're going to be thrown out of like their power structure. So they hate each other tremendously, but they found common ground. They all hate Jesus more because they're all afraid of him. One that he'll win, one that he'll lose, but either way, they know they got to take this guy out. Because he's sort of testing them and their power that they have and their hopes for what God is doing or what they want to do in the world, right? So they came up with this foolproof plan to ask him about this political tax. Should we pay it or shouldn't we? And it's a brilliant trap, because let's get rid of like the rebellion chances altogether. Let's ask him about the tax that you hate but we love because we benefit from it. If Jesus were to say no, so should we pay the temple tax? Or, I'm sorry, the tribute tax to Rome. If Jesus said no, we shouldn't, then he stays true to his Jewish faith and his call of being a Messiah, but he'll get killed or crucified for leading a rebellion and not paying his taxes. Like, he'll get killed. Like, they can just hand him over. In fact, it's what he was accused of when they handed him over to Pilate. They said, he is made himself a Christ, the false king, and he's encouraging people not to pay their taxes. And that's when Pilate had to take him. So if he were to say that, he's a dead man. He's dead. But if he says yes, then he's a false Messiah. He's blasphemous because he's encouraging this like graven image, sort of blasphemous existence. He'll lose the faith of the people. He'll be disposed. But even as a false prophet, as a false Messiah, if he's accused of blasphemy by the Jewish high council, they could kill him as well. Which is what they ultimately accused him of, is blasphemy, that he could tear down the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. And they said, that's enough, let's kill him. So either way, the man is dead. They created a trap that Jesus dies. It's like a genuine political assassination, right? Legit. Like, he has no way out. He's going to get killed. Very, very tricky situation. He's in a situation where there's like these two options, both are bad. It's very familiar. Right? Here, one or the other. Both of those are, I don't want these. So what's the third thing? And either way he goes, it could be trouble. So Jesus, as a genius, says, well, show me the coin. So they pull the coin out and they hand it to him. And he says, whose image is on it? And they're, well, Caesar's. He's like, well, it must be his. So give him what's his. Give to Caesar what's Caesar. But he uses the word image, and he's referencing Genesis 1, if you have the ears to sort of hear that, when it talks about whose image is on the coin, it says it's Caesar's, then give it to him. But on the flip side, when he says give to Caesar what's Caesar's, but give to God what's God's, the flip side of that is whose image is on you? You're made in the image of God, so give yourself to God. And there's this really interesting thing that he created where he's, it's like this epic example of the third way of Jesus, how he wouldn't engage in the either or, but he gives a different framework altogether, and it's kind of a double statement where he's not ignoring and he's not retreating from the power structures and the politics of the day, or like non-participating. He's like, respect Caesar and give him what's his, but worship God. And they're blown away because he got off the hook. But beyond that, I think he established an incredible way to engage our world of explosive politics today. I think he gives us a framework and a paradigm if we're going to be thinking in a kingdom sort of mindset. One is he absolutely prioritizes the kingdom. He prioritizes the life of the kingdom. He says, give to Caesar what's Caesar's, but give yourself to God. Like, there's this call that your ultimate allegiance is to Jesus and the kingdom. If you say Jesus is Lord in the full sense of what that is, if you were here when we had the kingdom movement, then what you're saying is the kingdom is your primary allegiance and your primary way of understanding the world and how you're going to engage. It trumps every other one. Any other allegiance that you had, whether it's political or national or ideological, whatever that is, now the kingdom of Jesus is your primary allegiance, this life of the kingdom. And then what he does is he detaches. So he prioritizes an allegiance to the kingdom, but then he detaches any sort of misaligned allegiances. I'm a Pharisee, or I'm a Herodian, right? I'm right, I'm left, I'm this party, I'm that party. But he says, you're the people of God, you're followers of Jesus, give yourself unto God. And that sort of transcends all of those other lines, and you're actually called to detach from those false allegiances, which is wild. And I've said this over and over again over the past several months, that if you are a person of the kingdom and your primary allegiance is to Jesus as your Lord, then all the allegiances you once had, you're like pulled up from them, if that's prioritized, and you're detached, and you sort of turn sideways, and you have a different alignment now to embodying a resurrection life for the healing of the world. And then he doesn't leave you up there detached. He re-engages you. That's his whole give to Caesar what's Caesar's, into the politics and the real world from that perspective. Give him what's his, but now you landed like sideways. So you don't align even Stevens anymore with the old binaries that they give you. You're in a very different kind of space. It says prioritize the kingdom, detach from your old allegiances, but now re-engage the whole thing differently. Think about it. Think about Matthew 8:20. Would you put that up? Jesus, someone said, Jesus, can I follow you? I want to follow you. And Jesus says, foxes have dens and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. That sounds a little weird as a response to, hey, can I come? But it's actually a political statement because they called King Herod that fox. And he's essentially saying, we're not part of that. He saw Herod has his system in his way, but I don't have any place to put my head. It's as if he's saying, we're not part of that system the way that it operates. We're distinctly different, and yet Jesus is still somehow face-to-face with all the powers of the day. It's like he says, you can come with me, but the spaces we're going to live in and traverse will leave you feeling homeless at times. You're not going to feel like you fit in fully anywhere now because you're part of the kingdom, which is transforming this world and transforming those different systems and like transcending them in different ways. That's the call of a kingdom life fully engaged. It's why when Pilate is attacking Jesus once he's handed over to be killed at the end of the story, at the end of the Passion Week, he's asking him these questions like, are you truly a king? And like, where's your kingdom? And there's like that whole sort of debate that's going on. And Jesus says, my kingdom's not of this world. It's distinctly different, yet fully engaged. And that's where we have to start. That's your starting point. That's your framework, that Jesus prioritizes a kingdom call. He detaches you from all your other sort of allegiances and then allows you to re-engage the whole thing differently. He doesn't run from it. He doesn't hide from it. He engages it full on, full on. So with that in mind, then it raises the question, what does it look like for us to engage a wildly crazy political world in our own right, right? So how do we do that here? Because we don't have Caesar and Denarius's and those things happening. What do we do with us? Well, what is our political world that we're looking at would be a bigger question to ask. There's a podcast back in 2016, kind of at the height of the polarization of that last election cycle. And Rob Bell and his Robcast did a whole episode just on like speaking sanity into some of the insanity and going, hey, politics is good, guys. Don't forget, we're lucky to be here. And I'm going to draw on that just a little bit Politics is a great thing. Often in the craziness of it, it's easy to throw our hands up and just be like, I'm over it. I'm so disenfranchised. I'm so frustrated. They don't get it. The other. But the reality is politics is a great thing, and you have to reframe that. It's easy to hide from it or want to throw it away or to hate it, but it's actually epic. The word politics that we have comes from the Greek word politikos, which just means citizens, which then, if you think about it in that sense, it's essentially how we arrange a common life together as citizens in a place. That's all that politics is. It's the process by which we get to arrange a common life together. It's like the arrangement of our bodies in a common space together, that we get to arrange what our life looks like, and that is our politics. It's our arrangement of a common life as fellow citizens in one place and time. And that's a gift, and it's become a dirty word in a lot of places. Like, we don't talk about politics at the family dinner table, but we do all the time, actually. We just don't call it that when we're engaging it in a healthy way, because it's a beautiful word, and it's really vital in our lives, and we're all really, really political. If you participate in a common life at all, if you drove here this morning on a road, if you used water out of your house or electricity, we're using electricity and water in this place right now, then the reality is you're really political, that you're benefiting from a system in which people were elected to create a system that works for our shared life together and how we get access to all of those things. We like politics, right? And we're very political, and we're engaged in it all the time. It's a good word, and it's a good thing, and that's awesome. And the truth of the matter is the way that politics works is policies. That's what politics is actually supposed to be about, but which comes from the word politics, and it's actually how like things get done in the world, is that our elected officials are appointed to create policies, like laws and regulations, that would state how we arrange ourselves. And the idea is that people fight, and that people would argue, and that people would eventually approve of policies that would form this body of how we operate together, which is like how you shape a common life together. And the idea behind that is, in our country, we get to choose representatives that would represent us on different policies that would benefit us as a people. Now, remind you, we're a really diverse nation with a lot of different people with a lot of different thoughts and a lot of different needs and a lot of different feelings. So, like, there is no policy where, like, everybody's so pumped right now. I feel like we really nailed everybody on this. Like, it doesn't exist. And so it's the whole thing is about fighting, and the whole thing is about argument, and the whole thing is about common ground and compromise and sacrifice to figure out what's the best thing for everybody and how we move forward as a people. Like, that, you're supposed to have arguments, and you're supposed to have fights, and you're supposed to have sharpening from different perspectives to figure out how do we benefit the most people, or how do we actually benefit everybody. Like, common ground to benefit the whole is the whole idea, and it's the only way that it works. The problem is when you think you're the only one who should get everything that they want. That's when it gets weird, right? Now, the system is super vulnerable, and it can get hijacked, and they're like, people obstruct, and we've seen it countless times over decades. This isn't a new thing, right? Or it gets turned into a show, or it gets turned into a personality thing, or other things step in, and there's other forces that try to buy it or fund it or profit from it or get favors from it, and that's really upsetting, but you can't abandon the whole project and reject it. We actually have to reclaim it, and we have to call it good and like, take it back. And I think it's been hijacked off and on in recent times, and it isn't a time to throw our hands up and fight each other. That would be foolish. Rather, it's a time to take it back, and that starts with understanding what it is. So there's who we are as a people, a kingdom people, who are called by Jesus to actually prioritize his kingdom, detach from prior allegiances, and then re-engage the world of our day differently. And then we've talked about what politics is. It's our system of shared life together, and how we engage that. But the question then, I think, is how do we actually enter into the engagement of this thing, right? So there's who we are, and there's what politics is that we have, but this is where it gets crazy. It's how do we now, as kingdom people, enter into this chaos, especially a full year and a half out from, like, another cycle of how it turns over in 4 years, right? Like, how do we engage it? I think at like, a really high level, there's a bit of shifting that needs to happen in our understanding of allegiance. I think it just starts there, really. And there's a couple of phenomenon that exist, kind of a resurgence of several phenomenon that are constantly trying to, like, sort of rise into influence and power. One of them is an idea of religious authoritarianism, distinct from, like, total authoritarianism, but, like, a religious authoritarianism is when a single religion wants to dominate a public space. And the reality is that isn't what's happening in an American context. Like Christianity has been on the decline for quite some time now. Between 6,000 to 10,000 churches close their doors every year, which is between 100 to 200 a week. Our last census had the largest decline of people self-professing to be Christians, like at one time drop ever, 8% dropped. But at the same time, there's a big rise in what you call the nuns, and there's this huge sort of resurgence of spirituality generally, but there's a rejection of a false nominal Christianity that doesn't live up to what it says that it is. And so, like, you see spirituality everywhere. You see, like, Soul Cycle. You see, like, yoga class. Like, people are hungry for it. People leave Soul Cycle. They're like, I've been to church, and they're crying, and like, ah, right? Like, you see it. Or even on a global scale, while this form of American Christianity that's perhaps lived hypocritically for quite some time is now being exposed and needs to have a rebirth into, like, a true embodiment of Jesus, which is what we're always talking about as a church community. There is globally a large rise of hunger for spirituality, but it's quite broad now. There's a huge resurgence of Islam. There's a resurgence of Buddhism. There's actually a global resurgence of Christianity, but mainly in the global South. And as that's happening, you see a ton of people wanting to have their faith shape the public space. I want to release you from the idea that this is a Christian nation. It's not. It's not. I don't know if it ever has been, not in a Jesus is Lord way, honestly. And so if we're saying, boom, this is like a religious authoritarianism and Christianity is going to shape all the politics of this nation, you need to open your eyes and look around that this is a pluralistic nation and there are lots of people with lots of voices that are trying to shape this space. And so you have to learn how to engage as a Christian and a person of the kingdom. I'm not saying we're not those people who are looking to engage fully as a people of the kingdom in this society. You just have to learn that everybody else is coming from a different place now. And how do you enter into that space? The other side is almost in response, and it's like a secular exclusivism that says we should get rid of all religions altogether and sort of live peacefully in a common world. And I want to release you from the idea this is a pagan nation. It's not. It's not a pagan nation you're at war with as Christians. It's a pluralistic society now. And it is, and now you're called to engage in a different way. That requires, man, some sophisticated theological thinking, like a winsome sort of understanding of who you are and what the Spirit's doing and how you engage with others in our country and in our world around us, especially as we're talking about if our politics are representatives trying to represent everybody in a nation to create sort of common life together and policies that benefit the whole. That's a whole nother conversation. That's a difficult sort of world to step into, and either one of those projects, like a religious authoritarianism or a secular exclusivism, it's not going to work. It's not going to work. We live in a plural world, and a lot of people want to stay in the public space, and it isn't going to work because you live in a growing religious world that wants to assert itself in a public sphere on a broad scale. And if you try to go after one or the other of those ideas, it's going to create a dividing conflict where we're not winning people over as with the witness of Jesus, but we're like stomping on them to get what we want. So the idea is, how do we actually engage it in a different way? How do we engage it in a different way? It's not a secular American. It's not a Christian America. It's something else. And so we have to think in terms of a pluralistic space where everybody has a voice. And what's a common life look like in that new sort of reality? Because that's the reality that we live in. And kind of that's a bit of a relief to me to just name that and recognize it and not fight against it. But actually go, okay, if reality is our friend, all right. Now, how do we be a kingdom people in the midst of this reality that we live in? I think beyond that, we have to recognize what Jesus meant when he talks about priorities of allegiance. Because we are Christians. We have a Christian context. You're disciples of Jesus and you're people of his kingdom, which then means you're not a party. You're not a candidate or a personality-based person. Jesus and his kingdom is your primary allegiance. In one sense, we're not political at all because we've disengaged from those false binaries as a kingdom people, but in another sense, if your life is a part of the kingdom, and the kingdom is how do we create a shared life to embody resurrection life for the healing of the world, everything we do is political because it's about a shared life together. Does that make sense? So in some senses, you're not in the ways our world operates. In other senses, you absolutely, entirely are in that we're ordering a shared life together. And to understand that in the complex reality of a pluralistic world, it means you're going to have a real strange existence. It means you're going to feel homeless in many ways. Because you can agree with one candidate and party on some things, but another on others. People from both sides will not fully ever understand you. You'll agree with the moral issues of some and the social issues of others. You're independent of this system, but you're absolutely committed to a shared life here in this place and to the life and community of Jesus. You're going to operate with love and grace and understanding, and you are going to be the kind of person that holds a bigger picture that actually allows you to transcend all those lines and those parties and issues, which in short just means you'll be like Jesus. They'll walk away and be amazed. Right? That's what they said when they asked him the question that was going to kill him. Oh, wow. That's a different way. Okay. Right? And somehow Jesus was the one that brought them all together in the first place. All so wild. That means, though, in this new world, especially at the highest levels, there probably isn't going to be that perfect Christian candidate in the sense that perhaps we used to imagine. There's not going to be a perfect candidate that embodies fully the way of Jesus as Lord. They wouldn't make it to the top if there was, right? I will not sell out on anything ever, and I will be absolutely committed. My speech, Jesus is Lord. Next question. No, that person ain't going to make it to the top. But what about Jesus is Lord? I believe he answered that. Well, I don't know. You know what I mean? It puts us in a different sort of space, in a different sort of sphere. There's not going to be perfect policies or systems if we're in a pluralistic world now. You're not going to fully align. It isn't going to happen. Which means it's going to require conversation. And it's going to require work. And it's going to require getting past like the smoke and mirrors of the show and actually digging into the depths of what's really going on beneath the surface and what's shaping policies in a shared life together. It's going to mean compromise and sacrifice. It's going to mean love and grace and unity and a real deep maturity and understanding to find common ground and a whole lot of work, which is the work of getting past the personalities and the theaters and the parties and the special interests and the lies to actually get down to the deep stuff of policy and character. You can vote for someone in something that isn't perfect and still have integrity. It's okay. That's the world that we live in. This is where we are. That's what it is to be a people of the kingdom. How do we get the most kingdom right now is the way that I'm always thinking, which means you actually have to be a disciple and you actually have to be highly engaged in a common life, in policy, with people, with your own discipleship, with rejecting the theater of it all. And you have to have a highly informed, intelligent conversations about the policies that shape our life together as Christians and how we can inform those things in light of God's kingdom, where we'd actually embody grace and love and unity. It would require an immense engagement with your own faith, your own understanding, your own living, as well as with a shared life together and all the issues that are at stake and at hand. It would require you to understand other people. It would require you to get past the either attack or avoid mentality that most of us live in on like a fear-based level and get through that to actually engage people that are different and think different and operate in love. In other words, you'd be a Christian. There's like a really engaged, intelligent one, right? Like you would just be like, I would just call you a Christian, like baseline, right? Which does mean work, and it also means that we're like everyone in this room won't agree on everything or fully align. You won't. If you're here and you're like, oh, if he's talking about politics, if he doesn't check all 7 of my boxes, I'm out. And I'm going to find somewhere that does. You ain't going to find it. You will not find a community or a church or a place where everyone agrees with all of your political thinkings right now. You won't. You can go hunt for it. You're just going to be lonely and miserable and kind of like turned inward on yourself. Or you can engage with other people and you can be sharpened. If we're all seeking to embody the life of Jesus together as a community, if this is our goal and we say Jesus is Lord, then we need all of us to come with our different perspectives and life experience and expertise to bring it to the table, to sharpen each other, to see areas we can't see. There's going to be some good engagement. There's going to be some good like dialogue and hopefully some good arguments. I dig on a good argument. It helps sharpen things, right? That's like good argumentation that actually shapes us into a different kind of a people. We should be able to argue together, coming from different perspectives, if we're fully committed to the life of God's kingdom and his scripture and to Jesus as Lord. And that will shape a different kind of unity. I think it'll put on display for the world what it could look like to be a people sharing a common life in the life of the kingdom, which would mean a couple of things. We'd be committed to a couple of things. One, this means we would reject absolutely the game and the show and the hijacking and the fear and the rants and the emotions. We don't do that. We're not doing that. Again, we're going to reject all that. Two is we would reject unhealthy divisions, like toxic, angry arguments, ignorant avoidance, or attacking. We would engage each other and other people with love and with respect, that you'd be a witness for Jesus in the world, which means some of you should probably just not be on Facebook ever. Ever. You should make a decision. Three is we would learn to actually see through a new lens. We have to learn to see through a new lens. You've been handed two options. And we've been told, this one's the one of the kingdom, or this one's the one of the kingdom. I've heard arguments for both. No. There's a new lens, and it's going to take work to step out of what you've been handed to step into something new. That's why we're talking about it now in 2019 and not 2020, because we'll have time to be ready. We'll have time to look at candidates and measures and politics and shared life through policy eyes with a kingdom lens, which means we'll engage it really differently. There's a theologian who's been trying to do this for a long time. His name is Miroslav Volf. He's done some incredible work on forgiveness, and then he got into, like, what does it look like to have a public life in a pluralistic world? And he has some really good work on that. Like, how do you think differently in terms of engaging a public life with our faith as followers of Jesus, but in a pluralistic world? And he did some work way back in 2012 and a lot of the divisions that were happening, and his book got released later in 2016, equally applied. It just keeps on. And the way he wrote this book was not addressing current issues in like explosive media-driven topics. He's looking at it much larger. So it actually has like a kind of a global influence right now, because people anywhere with whatever they're looking at are grabbing onto some of his work, because he's one of the few people that are laying out a sophisticated way of thinking about our discipleship and about the kingdom. And he says, there's 14 major areas you should be thinking about if you're thinking about our shared life together, that are shaped by the idea of the kingdom from the scripture. And these things will run across all kinds of people and candidates and policies in life, but Jesus is always very clear on what it means to be a people when we're thinking about these 14 sort of different categories is his idea. So you should be thinking in this sense and then applying that across. He's like, wealth, the environment, education, work and rest, poverty, borrowing and lending, marriage and family, new life, health and sickness, aging life, ending life, migration, policing, punishment, war, torture, freedom of religion or irreligion. He's like, you should be thinking in all of these terms, which again is why I said it would take work to actually think at that level and understand what's happening in your own life as someone who's following Jesus, if you're one who's wanting to engage the broader world and represent Christ in that sense. But then he says you should also be thinking about 5 points of character, someone's courage and humility and justice and respect and compassion. And he says, effectively, you're never going to find the perfect person, but you can find measures and candidates and policies that would embody the most kingdom, reflecting the most common good for our nation at this time. You can address character, and you can weigh all of that out together, and you can actually have integrity in that sense. It's a whole different way of putting on a different lens. And lastly, I would say, next to lastly. I would say get in the game. Don't stand at a distance and poke at it, or like turn other people into the other and like lob stuff at them. Get in the game. Pray. Pray for our country and our politics and our nation and our representatives. Get involved at a local level, at our city council here. Like read. Engage. Actually dig beneath the surface and be stretched and challenged and listen and practice the way of Jesus. There's a group in our church who I know gets together every time a cycle comes, and they do a ton of research collectively as a group and have a big like party one night. Sounds like a rager, where they compare all of the like research and like findings that they have and like try to wrestle together on where is the kingdom in this? It's too much for any one of us to take on entirely on our own. So how do we do it together as a community so we're sharpening each other and thinking, like, get in the game. Get in the game. Get past the theater and the games and actually get involved. A lot of the fights that happen are about media and about a show, and it's about smoke and mirrors. But this is about sacrifice and compromise and love and grace and unity and compassion. So get to good conflict and debate and understanding, and get past the lame stuff that doesn't help. That's really critical. And then lastly, as I said before, guys, the real power is the life of God that we embody and his inbreaking kingdom. So we're talking about how to engage these power structures that exist. All earthly power structures are transitioning power structures. Ultimately, it's about God and his kingdom, and he's putting the world back together again. He's redeeming and reconciling. Ultimately, at the resurrection, he's going to put everything back together again. The real power is in him. And that's our great call as a church, is that no matter what happens, we're embodying the life of that kingdom. It's faithful embodiment, faithful action, faithful witnesses of what he's doing in the world around us. And we're going to embody love and unity because we understand the reality of what it means to be a kingdom people in a pluralistic society. We're going to be healing, reconciling people. And so maybe for you guys, this is just a reminder to you. Maybe for others of us, it's like the beginning of a re-education and an engagement with your faith and how you understand discipleship and how you understand kind of politics in the world. But I would ask you the question, where is your primary allegiance? Where is it? Because you got to start there. Is it to Jesus or is it to something else? Is it to his kingdom or is it to some other thing, some other tribe, some other group, some other party? And I'm not saying that you have to disengage. Jen and I did a while back. We unregistered from any party. So that's how we're choosing to engage, so we can tackle this thing every time based solely on people and on kingdom and on policy. That's our hope and our goal. But I know other people that are saying, no, it's a two-party system, so we're choosing to faithfully engage as followers of Jesus within each of those. I know people who are doing that on either side, and they're saying, we know that this doesn't fully represent Jesus, but we want to see this thing redeemed from within, and that's great too. But my question is, where's your primary allegiance? Think it through. Think it through, because my hope is that we can begin a process together to come not only at the next cycle, but every day, every month, every year as a church of like faithfully embodying the kingdom in light of our shared life together. And there's so much anxiety in our world and in our nation. I just want to tell you, it's okay. It's going to be okay. Jesus is still on the throne. Jesus is still putting the world back together again. All power structures that exist are temporary power structures. And ultimately, at the resurrection, he's making a new heavens and a new earth, and he invites you to participate in that now, whether you see the full fruit of it or not. It's okay. We're okay. The church is actually at its best when it's on the underside. It loses its faithful witness when it gets that kind of power. It always has through history. It's a good thing to be on the underside as the church. It started that way on the fringes of a Roman Empire, and it exploded across the world. This is when we're at our best. This is it, guys. This is our moment to embody the life of the kingdom in a profoundly transformative way. There's a power in faithfulness, and we're going to continue to live out our faith and follow Jesus, and we'll continue to engage the world in which we live and our country, and it's beautiful. God's still God, and he's still redeeming, and it turns out America's not the savior of the world because Jesus is, and we're okay, and that's why we're a church, because we're embodying his life for the hope of the world, and we're not going to try to create crusading movements that force ourselves into the people, that just push them away. Don't get co-opted. Don't get hijacked by other ideals and groups. You're homeless, but you're very much at home here. And so we're in a new world with incredible new opportunities as a church, which I think is thrilling. And so may we be the church, and may we actually faithfully engage our nation and our world so that we can continue to pray and to live your kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. And also, may we have the grace and the love to actually walk with those who don't yet understand that reality so they can have the chance to see it and to enter into the life that's truly life. And so I recognize I just created a lot of questions for you and thought processes, and that makes me happy. So now engage it together and wrestle with it. What does it look like to fully embrace and embody this life of the kingdom in light of our shared life together? So I'm going to have the worship team come up. And I'm going to have the prayer team come up while the worship team comes up. So we have a prayer team that operates with us every Sunday. These guys are representing that team this morning. Some of them come to our weekly Sunday and staff meetings as we're prepping, and we're all praying together into what God's doing with us as a whole. They take that back to the prayer team, and they're praying with and for our community throughout the week and then also on Sundays. And you often don't see them because they're over there on the side of the room, but I wanted to bring them up so you can see them and say, we are a church that loves to respond and to pray. And so as we're entering into a space of worship, we invite you to receive prayer. It isn't like you're going to get prayer because there's a weakness or something's broken and now I need to get fixed. It's that we get to encounter the living God and these people who lovingly want to serve us as a church and say, I'm going to stand over here and be available to pray to every single person that would like to just receive prayer and encounter the Spirit. So wherever you're at, if you want prayer for anything, whether you're sick or whether you got something stirring in you or whether you just want to hear a fresh word from God or just an encouragement, whatever that is, we invite you to receive prayer. And these guys are going to be over here on the side of the room where they always are. But I want you to see them instead of just saying, there's prayer over there. So as we enter into a space of worship, that's where these guys are at. And then I'll also say, this can feel like a really intellectual thing, like politics and theology, and it's quite a sophisticated line of thinking to wrestle with. But it's actually like, it's a very people thing. Because it's about how we engage each other and come together as a community and how we orient ourselves. So even as we worship, this is very much like a communal, what does it mean to be friends and to be people and to be a church? So I encourage you to worship in that sense. Sound good? All right, as I pray for you guys, you want to jump over there? Father, we pray that you would speak and...